Yeah, working on that, or?
As it happens, Lori Adams is the AG's person.
And those should be available within the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, or? Is that also something that Coastal Policy Council will be reviewing on the 8th?
That is precisely so. They will, our drafts of this amendment language will be available within the next couple of days. Then on the 8th, we will have a meeting here in Juneau with the council and get as much of their endorsement as we can for the probably dozen areas of change for the act. And then as soon as possible, right after the 8th, on the 10th, it'll be transmitted to the legislature.
And you've indicated that there's a redraft of the regulatory reform?
Well, the hearing period closed.
Yes.
Today. And I assume now that we've already been talking about a lot of the issues that have come up. We've reached some tentative agreements and ideas on how to change the reform regulations to clarify some of the things that have come up. A new draft of those will be out within, I'm sure, a very short time.
Well, the Attorney General told us about 1:30 or whenever he tested, it was about 2 o'clock, I guess, that there was going to be, and I don't know, I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, but I took it to mean that that was going to be, I won't say postponed, but it would wait for the new Commissioner of Natural Resources to review and react to before there would be any movement forward on the regulations. Now, is that the way you understood it, Senator?
That's what
so
I heard, too.
Whether that's June 1st, July 1st, we don't know.
It may be the new draft that is going to be seeking the Commissioner's review on. I'm not sure. The last I had heard, a new draft would be coming out within the next few days, and would be seeking Mr. Katz's review. But that, I don't understand whether we're talking about a brand new draft from Mr. Katz or this stuff that was put out.
I don't know.
Well,
did you have any other understanding of that comment that he made? Did you hear basically the same thing I heard?
I'm not sure what you heard, but I don't have two options.
I mean, didn't you understand the Attorney General to say that they were going to give the new commissioner, but I don't think he's had any time on that, whether he waited until he became commissioner or whether that was going to be a part of the transition period, or?
We were just talking about this, matter of fact. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do.
Okay, thank you. Meeting's adjourned. Some simple terms, just how the consistency works and who makes what on a ruling as it is now, and then how it could possibly be under the commitment form.
Well, let me start off by briefly describing the way it's done now, because the way it's done now is something that I don't think anybody sees as satisfactory. As you're aware, when the original act was passed, one of its major goals was to implement the program through existing authorities rather than to create a new bureaucracy and have a new permit requirement. And so one of the sections of the bill says that the standards for coastal development, which the council develops, are to be implemented through state agencies through their existing authorities. The council took that statute and then wrote a regulation which said that when a state agency is confronted with a permit application in the coastal zone, that it is to look at that activity and see whether it's consistent with these standards. A very simple approach to implementing the statute. The problem is that sometimes activities need 5 or 6 different state permits, and under the regulation that the council wrote, every state agency who had permit jurisdiction over the activity was going to make a coastal management consistency determination. Now, that's a worse situation than the situation where you need 3 or 4 permits, because generally, the agencies are looking at different things. Fish and Game is looking at the bridge crossing. DEC is looking at the discharge. DNR is probably looking at broader things. But here the agencies are looking at the exact same question. Is this activity consistent with the coastal management standards? And there didn't seem to be a whole lot of reason to require an applicant to have that question answered 5 or 6 times, depending upon how many state permits he needed. I say 5 or 6, and in fact it was 6 or 7, because if he also needed a federal permit, the way the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act works is that before the federal permit can be issued, the state lead agency, currently the Division of Policy Development and Planning, has to certify to the federal agency that it's consistent. So you have the question asked yet another time. It was obvious from the outset how you cure it, and that's that you answer the question of whether the activity is consistent with the standards once. One person does it one time, and that binds the state, and then the person can go on to other issues. That's a very simple solution, and the question that I've been asked quite a few times is, why did it take the administration and the Coastal Policy Council 3 years to come up with a proposal? Obviously, if one person is to do it, the obvious question is who's going to be the one who does it. Right now, everybody does it. Everybody's turf is protected. And when you start dividing up the responsibilities so that one entity will do it, the oil industry, for example, will feel very strongly that the Department of Natural Resources should do it on all occasions, because they see the Department of Natural Resources as being more development-oriented. Environmental groups, on the other hand, want to see the Division of Policy, Development, and Planning making all the coastal management consistency determinations, because their current personality is perceived to be more environmentally conscious than DNR's. Don't make any judgments on the accuracy of either of those characterizations, but that's the way people come down. And the agencies themselves, of course, all think that they have the primary expertise to do the job. DEC would rather see DEC do it, DNR would rather see DNR do it. And because the pie could never get divided up, a solution was never found. Last session, the legislature, the Senate, passed SB 548, one provision of which said, hey, administration, or hey, Permit Reform Commission, a commission that the original bill would have created, solve this problem so that only one coastal management consistency determination is made. The bill didn't pass, but I think finally the fact that it got through the Senate and obviously reflected a lot of very deep concern was sufficient to get the administration on course, and the permit reform project was created in large measure because of that problem, because that really was the most glaring example of overlapping bureaucracy in state government.
You're talking now of the whole coastal management, when I say the whole, the coastal management consistency finding was the layering effect.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And on top of the fact that it was layered, these consistency determinations that all these agencies were doing on one project didn't have to agree. Agency A could say it was consistent, but that wouldn't help you at all when you went to Agency B and they decided it was inconsistent. Developing a workable division of responsibilities was hard, and it was hard because there is no answer to who should do it. As I say, depending upon your economic or your ideological outlook, different people should do it. Here's the proposal we came up with and what's in the regs. First and foremost, if you have an activity which is of major economic or environmental significance, the Trans-Alaska pipelines and Alpetcos of the world, that is an activity of such statewide significance that the question of whether it's consistent with the standard should be addressed by the governor's office. And so we gave the responsibility for those types of projects to the governor's office, to the Division of Policy Development and Planning. The threshold is whether an environmental impact statement is required. Second, we believe that for most state oil and gas matters, that DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, really, when it decides to hold an oil and gas lease, has to, under statute, make a determination of whether that lease sale is in the best interest of the state, which subsumes the coastal management standards. I mean, that's just one subset of all the things you look at in making a best interest finding. So we decided that it would be appropriate to give that part of the pie to the Department of Natural Resources. Third, except the third class of activities, these are ones that, for which are not the biggies, the ones we're given to the governor's office, don't involve state oil and gas lease matters. There are still a lot of activities that occur in the coastal zone that need some kind of federal permit. That federal permit already has to be certified by the Department of Environmental Conservation under the Clean Water Act. So for these residual activities, if we give the Coastal Management Authority to DEC as well, we have the coastal management issues decided without the need for any kind of separate permit proceeding. That would replace the residual. So it's a three priority. You ask three questions. One, does the activity need a federal permit for which an environmental impact statement is required? If the answer is yes, then DPDP will make the one consistency determination and you don't have to go any further. If the answer is no, the second question does the activity involve the disposition of an interest in state land or the approval of a plan of operations? If the answer is yes, DNR will do it and you don't have to go any further. If the answer is no, then you get the residual category. Does it need a federal permit that needs certification from DEC under the Clean Water Act? If the answer is yes, DEC does it. And for 99% of the activities of any significance in the coastal zone, you're going to get a yes to one of those three answers. We obviously could have divided it up differently. And again, as I said before, there are a lot of procedural criticisms that have been offered by both the oil industry, although I don't mean to single out the oil industry, but the remaining industrial segments that have commented on the regulation seem to think that this is a fairly reasonable way of doing business. We have had trouble with the oil industry, who thinks that the governor's office, DIP, shouldn't have any role, even when there's an EIS involved, and the DNR should always do the consistency determination. Environmentalists believe that DIP should do it all, or that everything should be appealed to the council. That's really both groups' bottom line. They will phrase these arguments in terms of, well, this is more complicated, although their substitutes are usually more complicated than what's in the regs. But what it gets down to, when you take away all of the procedural gloss, you get the bottom lines, and that's that we haven't given the authority to make this one state consistency determination to the right agency. And there is no clear answer as to who you should give it to.
John, in a case, going back to, say it's a, as I understand it now, you've said that in the proposed regulations, DNR for state land disposal, whether it be an oil, gas lease, whatever, would have the responsibility for issuing the consistency ruling. And would that include any federal permits that maybe would be Corps of Engineer permits and so on? Would they be making a consistency ruling on that, or does that all that still have to go to DPDP?
No, that doesn't go to DPDP. When we talk about the state making one consistency determination, we're talking about making for all purposes.
Okay.
So they apply for their or the oil and gas lease sale is failed. Actually, the oil and gas lease sale is not a good example because that's just a lease sale and there's normally no federal permits, but the plan of operations approval, where they're getting approval for wells. They'll apply to DNR for their plan of operations approval. DNR will make a consistency determination. When the related Corps permit comes up, the Corps will indeed ask DIP, because they're the procedural funneling agency. Hey, is this activity consistent? They, under the regulations, will ship them a copy of DNR's consistency determination without any amendments or supplements to it. They'll be required to use only DNR's.
Is there a council appeal process built in those regs?
No, there isn't. There's a council appeal process in the statute when you have an approved district program. Which makes sense, because when you have a dispute of the magnitude between a local government and a state agency, it seems to me that the legislature was pretty foresighted when it said take that one to the council. The regulations don't have an appeal mechanism when there is not, the regulations don't attempt to expand the statute to provide an appeal mechanism to the council when there's not an approved local program. And I believe the council recently passed a resolution saying that they don't want that appeal authority. But the question of an appeals board raises one of the fundamental problems that, again, there's no easy answer to. And let me tell you what the criticism is. The criticism is when you give, well, let me put it bluntly with respect to DNR. When DNR is making a consistency determination on its lease sales, the fox is guarding the hen house. It's deciding whether its own projects are consistent with the coastal management standards. Now, the oil industry thinks that's fine. They think they ought to do it more often. Environmentalists think that's terrible and think that if you're not going to give it the dip-dip at the outset, at very least, you ought to have some kind of appeals board so that oil and gas lease sale decisions can be appealed to either the council or some kind of interagency board. It's a tough problem to grapple with. But right now,
yeah,
the rates don't go
okay. Since you brought up the topic of the local government being involved in this, I have a copy of a memorandum that you wrote to the governor on the 27th of January that implies, I think it implies anyway, there were three points that you were making. And the third point was that, or maybe it's a recommendation rather than a point, that it should defer the resolution of the question of the weight to be given local government comments on coastal management consistency issues. And then you go on to say, although this issue must someday be resolved, resolution is not vital in these regulations, and the controversy is an albatross around the regulation's neck. From what you've just said, it appears that that recommendation was not followed, and that local governments, for the purposes of the regulations, are considered to be a resource agency, and their comments in an approved plan, where there is an approved plan, their comments, in essence, have the same force and effect as a FDNG or any other resource agency, and if they were to say it is inconsistent with the local plan and probably would have to make the findings showing why it was, then they could have in effect a veto.
Well, it's not it's been characterized as a veto.
I guess I don't understand what great weight is.
Okay. Well, great weight is not a self-defining concept. What we were trying to, we looked at the Act, and it didn't look to us like the way the Act was written, that it was intended to give local governments a veto. Nonetheless, we didn't want to write regulations that simply said you have to consider local government comments, because it didn't mean anything. You might as well not say anything. We came up with great weight because the term has been used in case law in analogous circumstances. What it means is that if the local government says that it's inconsistent, it's possible for the state agency, if there is strong evidence in the record, that they can write down and say, they can write in their decision, we find these facts, and for these reasons, we believe that the local government is wrong. And if they put together a strong evidentiary case on the record, they can come to a contrary conclusion. But once they get, if they get to court, or certainly they would go to the council from there if there's an approved district program, if the local government disagreed, but eventually got to court, the local government would have the upper footing in terms of the allocation of creates a presumption that the local government's right and the state's wrong, and the state has to build a strong case on the record to disagree with the local government. Now that to me is not a veto, because it can be, it's an overridable veto, I suppose, but it's as close. It gives local government a significant amount of authority that we feel comfortable with under existing law. And if the legislature's decision is the local governments ought to have more authority, then once they have an approved program, darn, it's their ball game. Then I think the law should be changed to say that, the Coastal Management Act.
I've been dominating. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, you have. No, I just like to ask
I don't get to gavel very often.
I don't mind the nomination at all. I was just in this line of thought. I was sitting here thinking about the testimony that we've had so far on coastal zone management, et cetera, as we looked at this whole picture. And I was wondering, under this concept that you've just discussed, with the local government not having veto power, but having a very strong say, do you see, truthfully, any area of the coast that could be developed of any resource? Without being stopped?
By the local government?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a threshold the local government has to get over, and that's it has to get its plan approved. And so, if the local government, if the local government puts together a plan, the operation of which is to thwart development, then the first stop, obviously, is to not have the council approve it. If the council does approve it, the council is a pretty broad-based organization representing a whole lot of different interests. They're not environmental crazies. I think the odds of the council willy-nilly approving the Sierra Club program are not all that good. But what it gets down to is that I think that if a local government puts together an anti-development plan, the council approves it. I think it was the spirit of the act, but that's fine. The spirit of the act was not pro-development or anti-development. It was pro-local government, and that cuts both ways. If you remember, I know Senator Gilman does. When the act was passed, the pro-development interest in the state—I hate to use names, but developers. We're all in favor of the approach in the bill, and all in favor of the strongest possible role in local government, because at that time they perceive local government as being far more inclined towards heavy development than the state. Well, along comes the North Slope Borough and the Beaufort Sea lease sale, and all of a sudden these same people who have been spouting the home rule line become very much states' riders, states in terms of the state, not local government, and believe that local government should have a very minor role. If you're going to have a piece of legislation that affirms strong home rule in municipalities, then you're going to have to realize that sometimes those people that you're giving this authority to are going to come down in an ideological position which is different from your own. And that's the whole idea of giving them that authority if theirs to exercise. Kind of like somebody observed recently that there's no such thing as a federalist anymore. States' riders are states' riders only to the extent that the particular economic interest is being protected. It's the same quandary here.
Well, do you see a danger for our state, and it's we've been compared many times to an underdeveloped nation, and in this stage of our development, do you see any danger to this concept that's put forth in this provision at our proposed regulation, as far as our abilities to develop our resources?
It's a pretty heavy question.
Yeah, but that's what I'm worried about.
Well, let's go back. I think that to the extent that you perceive dangers in the regulations, it's because your perceptions are really at the statute. I think the regulation pretty closely reflects what the legislature wanted at the time, which was not a local veto, but a real legally protectable, strong local voice. Whether that poses a danger or not, I just don't have an answer for that.
I don't want to be interpreted as not being for local voice. I am, to the extent that it does not completely tie the hands of the state as far as being able to have any economic base at all, because some of these, some areas, you know, are perfectly willing, as long as the state's willing the money, sit there and let the status quo remain forevermore, which is great, as long as forevermore we're able to economically afford that. Do you see where I'm coming from? I believe we can develop and protect our resources at the same time, and this really concerns me.
Well, let me just say, in defense of the regs, and of course there's no private authorship involved here at all, but they are in the middle. I mean, you can come down three ways on local state relations and coastal management. You can say in the statute and in the regs that the states just have to read local government comments and go on and do what they want. On the other extreme, you can say they have a veto.
Or you can strike a middle ground and say, hey, you better do what the locals want unless you have darn good justifiable reasons not to do it. That's the middle ground that we've taken. And, you know, if it's the legislature's desire to go either way from there, it was your act to begin with. That's your prerogative, obviously.
John, in the permit reform, if the Senate Bill 216 actually passed and survived a governor's veto, etc., what would that, the removal of the Coastal Management Act, what would that do to the permit simplification process? It would make it a much easier process to work through, right?
It would make the regs much shorter.
Make them much shorter.
You know, there are several goals in the regulations, and many of them have nothing to do with the existence or non-existence of the Coastal Management. Setting up uniform permit procedures so that people can learn one procedure and know how to deal with everybody in state government. Setting feasible deadlines so people can plan that permits will be out within a day certain, although people disagree as to whether it's too short or too long. These kind of things can certainly, are certainly worth pursuing on their own, apart from the resolution of the coastal manager problem. If the question is, does a year's worth of permit reform work go out the window if you repeal the act? The answer obviously is no.
Okay. Any other questions, Jay? Senator Kay?
No, I'm very comfortable with what I'm hearing.
Well, thank you all for your time.
Thank you for taking your time to come down today. I'm sure we'll be discussing these farther.
May I make one comment?
Yes.
I have a feeling here that environmentalists and oil and gas and the Attorney General's office and the governor and some of the senators and so forth feel like we're just trying to cram things down people's throat. But I just hope people understand that I, for one, and I know my colleagues are, we're trying to find answers of how we solve what I consider major problems that have existed for years.
Before you leave, I have one further question. And that deals with the powers of local government, recognizing that the resource service districts are a different creature at least at this point in time. It's been stated that and I think I've made the statement myself, that really the Coastal Zone Management Act does not give the local government any more power than it already has under its normal Title 29 functions. That they could exercise the same, through zoning processes, the same, basically the same authority that this act purportedly gives it. And I think the jury's still out on whether that is true or not. I think there's a lot of local government officials that feel that have that as a central question in their mind. All right, so we've adopted a plan, or we're going to adopt a plan. plan, is that really going to give us any additional local control? And that's where we come back to the consistency ruling. The ruling is not, at this point, a local ruling. It is not a local government ruling, other than, quote, great weight that's given to comments. In other words, the local government is commenting on its own regulations.
Well, it would depend in the first instance how specific the plan was. If the plan said that this acre is an industrial acre, it's for gravel extraction, and they then comment to the state agency that this gravel extraction plan is consistent with their program. And because of the specificity of the plan, the state agency just would not have the ability to develop the evidence to show that it's not, that local government was wrong. So there, it would be the local government decision. It puts a burden on the local governments to write specific plans and not to write generalities, because that just gets into trouble later. But you're right, it is not a local veto. And I think that the ambiguity, that the question in local government officials' minds as to whether they're getting more authority is because the courts in the state have made it far less than clear what authority they've got now. The question always comes up, what happens if the state wants to hold an oil and gas lease sale in the North Slope Borough, and the North Slope Borough owns that land, park, recreation? The issue of whether or not the action of the state sale would preempt that local zoning ordinance so the sale could go ahead, or whether the local zoning ordinance would prevent the lease sale. If you were to take a poll in our office, it would be 50-50. It is very open, very ambiguous. Whereas under the Coastal Management Act, the extent of their authority is clear, and if it's the legislature's desire that it be stronger, it can be equally clearly stated through amendments to the Act. That's the advantage of the Act, is it sets out the ground rules, and it gives you a very identifiable place to change them if you don't like them, rather than just relying upon court decisions, which may be 10 or 20 years down the pike still.
Isn't it true that the governor can set aside the zoning regulation within a municipality for the public good or for public interest?
I think that that's true of certain agencies, but the reason I use the example of the oil and gas lease sale is the activities would be conducted by private lessees as opposed to the state itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have several other people that wish to discuss this issue with us. I'm going to ask Murray to go last. And what I'd like to have you discuss, other than answer questions possibly about the consistency, some of the recommendations that may be coming from the Coastal Policy Council that might deal with some of this. Jamie Linksweiler.
You want to ask questions first?
I think you had indicated to me that you might have some comments on specific situations that dealt with consistency.
Before I
kind of lay it out so that we can see it from a perspective of what actually happens out here in the real world.
Before we get into these situations, I'd just like to say one thing. It's obvious that John and I disagree. It's also obvious the law is real and certain. Rather than us to continue to speak in what might be thought of as hyperbole or sit here and listen to the distasteful spectacle of lawyers arguing both ways to you, I would just suggest you read sections 160 and 570B and the definition of great weight in the regulations that he has prepared. Those three sections, the definitional section 160 and 570, are where we can see that the balance is tipped in terms of control over state activities in favor of a local government, something that doesn't exist now. It's very clear, as John, I think, correctly stated, that it's real uncertain what would happen under the present state of law if a borough, any borough, were to zone an area not for development and the state would have had the whole lease sale there. It would be difficult under Article 12 of the Constitution and Title 29 for the court simply to say that the local government has no authority. My point that I was trying to make before was simply that this is changing the rules of the game. That's the way I look at it. John doesn't think it changes the rules of the game, and we respectfully disagree, and that's about all I can say about that. This what I have here, and unfortunately it's only in draft form, is sort of the litany of problems we had with the Sag Delta well 7 and 8. Those are the first two wells to be drilled into the Beaufort Sea lease sale area, along with the Challenge Island well, which has been completed now. These are the first three wells that were drilled in the Beaufort Sea immediately offshore of Prudhoe Bay. They're drilled from artificial gravel islands, which were built there about the 15th and 16th wells to be drilled in the Beaufort Sea since we started operations out there 5 or so years ago. There's no convenient way to read this into the record. What this is a table, and I guess I'm just going to have to do as best I can to extract from and give you a copy of it later because it's got some problems with it that we'll get to you. As I said before, we started very early in the permitting of this operation. Now, drilling in the Beaufort is a tremendously complex operation undertaking that involves many sort of timelines all coming together at one time, and that is the time that when you start to drill a well, you've got to have a rig available, you've got to have the tools ordered, brought up on the sea lift the year before, you've got to have monies committed way in advance of any time that you can get a permit. You're hanging out there with $5 or $10 million, $12 million in financial commitments before anything comes along. We take these glitches that occur in the permitting consequently very seriously because we're committed many, many dollars to this sort of operation. I believe that the Sag 8 artificial gravel island, which is built in slightly deeper water than the Sag 7 island, cost us about $12 million, the island alone, before we got around to hiring the rig and drilling the well and so forth. So I think the entire cost of the well was up around $20 million. That's my recollection. It may be wrong, but I believe that those figures are basically correct. And as I said, it means bringing together over the course of 6 or 8 or 10 months just an awful lot of equipment and material all to bear on the site at once. What I have here is a table that goes through all the permits that were required on three activities, on Sag Delta 7, which is a well drilled by Sahio into its own leases, Sag Delta number 8, drilled by Sahio into an Amoco Amerada Hess well lease, also purchased the Beaufort Sea lease sale. And a third thing, which was the something called the East Dock Mud Sump, the mud sump being a place to get rid of the cuttings out of the hole, that is to say, the hole that we drag out when we drill it, and the mud being the primary well control and lubricant instrument, which is circulated through the well.
A mud sump is sort of like a great big swimming pool. It's made of gravel dikes, and it's maybe 100 yards by 200 yards or something in that effect. It's fairly large. It's maybe 8 feet deep, and it is ultimately filled up with this stuff. This particular dike was going to enclose the mud sump. We intended, when it's done, to cover it with gravel and to use it as a storage pad later so that we wouldn't be duplicating facilities and be able to use it for multiple purposes, basically. That on Sag Delta 7, it shows that the Division of Minerals and Energy Management Lease Operations Permit, which is the primary surface permit to be obtained from the state, there being the three basic permits, the downhole permit from the state, with the permit to drill or deepen,
the lease operations permit, which is the surface, and the Corps of Engineers permit, which is also a surface permit, completely duplicating the state permit. The state surface permit took 197 days to obtain. It was applied for on February 20th, 1980, and was obtained on July 10th, 1980. The permit to drill took only 9 days, and that's the permit completely handled by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is basically outside the realm of any discussion we have here today. That's more or less an independent agency with only the specific focus on downhole activity. During the 197 days that were taken up, a tremendous lot of interagency discussion went on, as you can imagine. I don't know quite how to characterize it. I'm certainly not here to point any fingers at any agency, because an agency like BPDP that puts itself in the role of clearinghouse for consistency and other purposes kind of gets the finger pointed at it almost unjustifiably, in the sense that if some other agency hangs them up on consistency or other reasons, then they're the bad guy. They're not necessarily the bad guy, and it's not any particular agency or any particular personnel in any agency that we're pointing at. It really is the problem is with the process. The problem's always been with the process. During that 197 days, a tremendous lot of conversation, discussion, you might call it bureaucratic infighting, went on about the terms of the wells, and so forth. Maybe that's all I better say about what went on. It also involved the Corps of Engineers permit. Now, this is where we really got crossed up with the Corps, was that the Corps issued us a permit in 4 months and 10 days, but 130 days, which is maybe 30 days longer than it normally takes them. The Corps is the subject of a lot of agencies working at cross purposes, I guess is the most diplomatic way to put it. Agencies in the state government comment the DNR on DNR permits, and then they comment separately through DPDP on the federal permit. The process, if it goes in the most orderly fashion, which it oftentimes does on a non-controversial project, works relatively well, and things happen relatively simply. When you get tangled up in the area of consistency, all these things are happening in the coastal zone. Pluto Bay is, I guess, more or less completely in the coastal zone. Activities, nearshore activities like these 2 or 3 miles offshore, probably in the coastal zone too. Then it all gets tangled up. And there's I think, no clearer way to say it than that the system sometimes can break down as it presently exists. It's not the result so much of any personnel or even any department. The problem basically is there is no mechanism, as it exists now, either within or without coastal zone management, for the state to state, once and with finality, its position, its policy on any particular activity. There's no orderly way for that to happen. The reason it gets crossed up is the DNR does that for state permits, and then when you turn around and you go to the Corps permit, DPDP is doing that, but DPDP is really not doing it itself. It's sort of processing other agency comments and passing them on. I use the mud sump as a third example. The mud sump, it says here that the Corps of Engineers permit took 225 days. I was intimately involved in
obtaining the Corps of Engineers permit on the East Dock mud sump, because at that time, the Corps had issued a permit that said that we absolutely could not dispose of mud and cuttings offshore, something that turned out later to be modified. But at that time, this permit was of crucial significance. Without it, we couldn't drill the wells. Without that structure, there was just no place to put the mud and cuttings. Of the 225 days, I would say about half of that, about 100 days of that, was the result of the state processes, for whatever reason, simply not working. It just brought things to a complete standstill. I at one time had in my possession, and I will obtain for you, Senator Gilman,
I think, 8 straight extension letters from the state seeking 15 days. It's sort of an interesting thing because each extension letter is about one sentence long, and it says on, let's just make up some dates, on July 15th, I apply for a 15-day extension to July 30th. I hereby ask for a further 15-day extension to August 15th. The next letter would say exactly those things except switching the dates 15 days ahead. On August 1st, I ask for a 15-day extension to August
15th. Who was asking for this?
Well, this was coming out of DPDP. I'm not sure that DPDP was at all the guilty party. I believe that they were held up by another agency, perhaps ADF&G. But it's all happening.
Is it simply because of consistency?
Well, here's... I mentioned before, this is where things get a little confused, because there are special rules applicable to consistency review that the Corps of Engineers has. The state clearinghouse review, as we've come to understand this, and I may be mistaken in this, and certainly Murray will clear this up if I'm wrong, as I understand it, the DPDP basically continues to fulfill a clearinghouse role to receive all state comments and pass it on. What happens, whether it's as a result of what DPDP has said at some point or as a result of what the Corps wishes to consider it, they call it all consistency. Everything coming out of DPDP is the consistency review because, among a lot of other things like just agency comments and just the position of the state and so forth, one thing that they're doing is consistency review. And the Corps of Engineers, therefore, can't move under its own regulations until it receives the consistency review. There are special rules applicable to consistency review in the Corps of Engineers. The public must respond and other agencies must respond within 30 days. Under consistency review, you get 180 days to respond to the Corps of Engineers. The upshot is that if the Corps thinks they're waiting for a consistency review, they will summarily grant extensions right up to the 180 days before they're forced to move. The upshot of all this is the wells got drilled, the mud sump got permitted, and one could say that it was a wash, that really nothing happened. After 150 to 200 days of a lot of people trying to make, the development of the Beaufort Sea, the development of the Kuparuk oil field, and all of the other developments that are going to be happening up there in the future. There are 3 or 4 other oil fields that are more or less identified, more or less on their way to production now. The Duck Island unit is just one that comes to mind down the coast from Pluto. There just isn't going to be a way to make lots of decisions fast and in the way they have to be made. When you get around to the job of building oil fields, you're really looking at a 2- and 3-year long timeline. And if any component on the timeline gets thrown out of kilter, and on these shorter timelines, as complex as they are, these exploration rigs, exploration, well, it's really not that difficult in terms of their complexity in comparison to building an oil field. If any of those things get thrown out of kilter, as they already have, the whole process can be ground to a halt.
And you don't think the commit reform will help that? You think it's going to muddy it?
I think it's going to muddy the waters further. I've explained that. I'm certain that I disagree with John Tillinghast on the matter. I'm sure he thinks it will make things simpler. Our view of it is that it will simply muddy the waters. It sets into stone processes which we think are disordered now. It creates new procedures where previously there were none. It creates public notice and appeals procedures that didn't previously apply and so forth. So we think it'll muddy the waters. The bottom line to all this, Senator Gilman, is just this. There were 4 or 5 major environmental problems applicable to construction on the slope. In no particular order, they are providing an adequate depth of gravel to insulate the permafrost, providing adequate culverting to avoid significant effects upon sheet water runoff that occurs during breakup, providing adequate and environmentally responsible sources of the gravel, which you must build all things upon. Issues like that. We've known about those issues. Prudhoe Bay was built consistent with those issues. There have been, at the time Prudhoe Bay was constructed, perhaps fewer culverts placed in some of the roads than might be, but I think that problem even has been corrected. So when you step back and look at the system, you ask, what has coastal zone management added to environmental protection? We're still doing things the same way we always did. Now it's taken us 9 months, 8 months, 7 months to get permits.
I think you said in the other testimony that you were averaging someplace like 60 days to 90 days of getting permits. Pre-coastal zone management.
Yeah, 40 to 50 days.
40 to 50 days, and now it's...
Well, on major projects, it's significantly longer. I think...
Did you, you know, being fair,
yeah.
You also said pre-Corps of Engineer wetlands.
That's right. Well, that's why this is such a complex, like a tremendously complex problem, because the complexities on the state side interface with the complexities on the federal side and create a real maze of bureaucracy to go through. Creating something called coastal zone management on the state side interfaces with already existing federal permit regulations, and that it's partially a state problem, partially a federal problem, and partially a question of the interaction of the two of them. To be fair, you're right. A good part of the problem comes from the Corps.
Yeah, if coastal management were to disappear,
if coastal management were to disappear, you would still have problems, but they wouldn't be like they are now.
Senator, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just get something clear in my own mind here as we go along. That when you go through this 197-day process, are you talking that this would be an average for each and every island you put out there, or does the first one take the blunt of it and then after that they come a little easier?
Well, I don't want to say that every island is going to run into the conflicts that we had over those. Those certainly were the first, and they certainly were sort of as bellwethers, more or less, received a lot of...
But you would then, looking back or looking forward, maybe looking both ways, that you would anticipate that that you wouldn't be running into the same permit problems once you've opened up the ground to do it, or however you want to say it. You see what I'm driving at?
I see precisely what you're driving at. I would like to say that things will get easier. I don't know why they should, though. One would assume that they might, but it's not built into the process to make things easier. You're relying on people getting familiar and comfortable with development going on in the Beaufort Sea, and therefore they would quit objecting quite so vehemently. That's a possible situation.
Another question along the same line. You're talking about the one permit taking you 197 days in the mud holding, permit taking 120 days. Were you running these parallel? Or did
you... Oh, these are all running parallel. They're not running end to end.
I don't sit here with the assumption that we went 197 days with one permit process and then had to go on another 120 days with that. So the total time spent on the permit system, then getting all the permits needed to drill the well, ran from 9 or 10 days with one agency up to them. By the time you got the 197-day permit, you had everything that was green and go.
This says 197 days. Part of the problem I have with this table, and the reason I wanted to double check it, is I'm not sure it's as long as 197 days, because it goes from 220-80 to 710-80, which is more like 147 days or 150 days or something, and not 197. But
it's considerably less.
Yeah, the point in any case is that it's significantly extended permit time than they had been just a year or two earlier. And I think every outlook is that this situation will continue.
Then when that 147 rather than the 197 days were by, that'd give you all the permits you needed. They'd give you the right to drill down the ground, give you the right to build the island, and they'd give you the right to dispose the mud and the chippings, or whatever you call it, in the industry.
There were three activities being permitted in parallel, and each of those three had three basic sorts of permits being obtained: the state surface, the federal surface, and the state downhole permits. That only happens, you're only ready to go when you have all nine permits. And as I said, some of those nine permits took quite a bit longer than some of the others did. So.
Yeah, but what was the time from the time you walked in the door and say, I want to start the permit process on this island up there so I can drill, so you got the last permit that you could put the equipment on there and start drilling?
I thought you said 225 days.
225 days was the time it took to go on the East Dock Mud Sump from time of application, which was April 3rd, 1980, shown here, to November 14th, 1980.
And that was the mud sump that took that time, so...
That was the mud sump, not the...
But he couldn't drill anything until he had it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I thought that he said, and to play the devil's advocate a little bit more before I get off it, that you probably spend... How much time do you spend, or how much time does industry normally spend in looking at an area and deciding whether they want to go in and drill there? Do you decide this in 30 days, or does the industry decide in a new area in 60 days' time that they want to go and drill? Or just how much time does the industry spend in looking at a brand new project, brand new area that they don't have any history on before they want to go in and invest that $26 million or whatever that figure was?
In this particular instance, we started looking at these particular tracts, which are immediately offshore at the mouth of the Sag River, immediately offshore of Prudhoe Bay, very adjacent to leases that we have held since 1965. We've been looking to drill them. We've been waiting for them to come up for sale, and we grabbed them when they came along, about 10 years. These particular leases. That isn't always the case. If we'd gone into a new frontier area in which we'd had no activity, we still would have looked. We put together a team pre-lease sale that evaluates from a geological perspective that the properties that are available for 6 months to a year, depending on what the sale area is, and then continues to evaluate which areas within that sale area they wish to. They wish to drill as seismic activities go on, and that sort of data is generated. Here, there was a tremendous lot of data up front because we've been drilling in the area immediately adjacent to this. So
you'd say that you'd certainly, before industry commit this $20 million or whatever it's going to take, that they'd certainly be looking at it 6 months a year and gathering information.
Oh, absolutely. The tricky part of all this, and really the bottom line, why the permits hurt so much, there's two things going on. Why the permit delays hurt so much is that the leases are finite. You've got to drill them or lose them within a certain number of years. And the second thing is that while you're waiting for your permits and not sure if you're going to get them and not sure upon the terms upon which you're going to get them, you've already made all these financial commitments and you're just hanging out.
Well, I guess where I'm coming from on it, obviously, is that if industry can spend, oil industry can spend a year or two or three or four out there searching and seeking and where they want to make that investment, I personally don't think that it's maybe unrealistic to let those that who it's going to affect to spend maybe 6 months looking at the result of what that exploration might do. You know, that I would certainly want, if the industry went right out in the middle of a crab bed where my constituents are catching crab, and after industry had spent a year or two or three or four looking at it and deciding whether it was worth the investment or not to go ahead and go apply for the permits.
I agree.
I think that the fishing industry certainly should have time through the permit system to at least 120 days or 147 or even the 248 days to respond to that and look at it and see what the impact is going to be as far as that industry goes.
The state started working on this sale as a part of the Point Thompson sale about 4 years ago and started focusing on the Beaufort sale upon which these leases were sold. I think in fair round terms about 2 years before the sale was held, and certainly in the last 6 months exerted thousands of man hours in evaluating just the sorts of effects you're talking about pre-sale. Because pre-sale, something has got to happen that's really significant here that we haven't talked about, and that is under Title 38.05.035.A.14, kind of a long string of a statutory site. The steps are laid out in that place for the state to go through before it can hold a lease sale. And A.14 requires the commissioner to find that the sale is in the best interest of the people of Alaska, to go through precisely the kind of balancing environmental steps that you're talking about. There was an EIS prepared on that sale because it was held jointly with the federal government.
I appreciate that part.
1,500 pages of documents. There was a 100-page best interest determination made on behalf of the people of the state of Alaska, which virtually completely, apart from a short discussion of the economic impacts and the economic advantages to the state of Alaska in holding the sale, basically focused on the impacts upon the natives and the subsistence effects upon coastal zone management program, and basic overall environmental effects, including effects upon the endangered bowhead whale, which is in the area. So this is happening.
I understand this process. What does the permit process do to protect the people there?
Beyond what's already happened.
Yeah. Why does Fish and Game get into it? You know, why are we asking the ADF and G people to look at each permit?
I guess I would say, coming on the heels of so significant and an inquiry into the environmental impacts of the sale, they're obviously out there determining the impacts on the environment. They're obviously out there determining whether it's okay to drill. They're obviously out there doing those environmentally protective things that they're required by the statute to do. Coming so closely on the heels of so complete a run-through as occurred pre-Beaufort T. lease sale, there comes a question in your mind as to just what depth is appropriate, how long it should take, and so forth. That's, I think, where we come. We're not here to deny the state of Alaska or the people of the state of Alaska, or to argue in favor of this. Denying them the right to evaluate something from the perspective of the impacts it might have on the environment or upon fisheries or upon subsistence or anything else. And far be that from what we're here talking about. What happened there, though, was quite to the contrary. Before that lease sale was held, that was exhaustively examined. All of these agencies had been heard from. And what happened on our permits was some fairly narrow things. I'm not entirely certain that 225 days worth of environmental evaluation went on. A certain amount of that, I won't even speculate on what was going on. I feel relatively certain that there wasn't 225 days of studying going on. It may have been other things.
I'm here to learn about the permit process because I've never been involved in it outside of hearing that there are some real problems with it. But what then, when you request one of those permits to drill in the Beaufort Sea or the Shelikof Straits, what then are they looking at? What then is ADF and G looking at when they look at your permit?
Well, apart from the sort of
answer in 30 days.
Apart from the sort of general. Apart from the general studies that had gone on pre-sale, one would assume that they're looking at two specific things. One related to site-specific effects of any kind of development that would go on. Like, is this in a known high productive fishery zone or something to that effect? And secondly, as to the sorts of activities that are going to be conducted there, are they going to be conducted in an environmentally responsible manner? That's something that Fish and Game has been doing for years. As I said earlier, on our old 1964, 65, 67, 69 lease forms, under which virtually all the oil and gas in Alaska is being produced. This includes the oil in the Cook Inlet, it includes the oil in the Kenai Peninsula, it includes Prudhoe Bay, it includes all the other oil fields to come into production in the future. They all say the same thing on the back. No surface operation can be conducted until it's cleared with Fish and Game. That's basically what it says, and the point is to protect habitat. One could argue from that it's not even necessary to go into regulations providing for that because, you know, it's sort of like it's part of the contract we have with the state of Alaska. We bought it subject to those constraints, and by golly, we're going to develop it subject to those constraints. They've always done it that way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie.
My pleasure, sir.
Don Glass?
Chairman Gilman, Senator Mulcahy. My name is Don Glass, and I'm with the Shell Oil Company located in Anchorage. I'm here today representing the Alaska Oil and Gas, Association, whose 32 member companies account for the bulk of oil and gas exploration, production, and transportation activities in Alaska. The association is well into the second year of a study on regulatory constraints facing our industry and has presented oral and written testimony at every opportunity on the proposed uniform procedures. Pertinent written material will be left for the use of committee members desiring further details on our position. We would like to use the time today to highlight our views on the portions of the uniform procedures that deal with CZM consistency, which are considered of utmost importance to our industry. In general, we do not believe that the proposed regulations will streamline the state's coastal management decision-making process. A good start was made at alleviating existing problems, but complicating factors were then introduced which, in our view, negate those benefits. On balance, we feel that delays and limitation of access to energy resources will be at least as great as they have been in the recent past. A good start was made in avoiding agency overlap and confusion by adoption of a lead agency concept, where a consistency determination was required, a knowledgeable lead agency would be designated to receive comments and render a single consistency determination which would suffice for both federal and state purposes. It was an excellent beginning. The problem as we see it is that the designated agency will be hampered and thwarted from performing a lead agency role. It must accord for many of the reasons that have already been discussed, but just to briefly go through them. It must accord a coastal district with an approved program the same status as a state resource agency. And it must accord great weight, including deference under many circumstances, to its recommendations. It must defer to such resource agency with primary expertise if no balancing of competing factors is involved. Now we ask that, in some of our earlier comments, that consistency be specifically referred to as including balancing. But it is interesting to note that in the latest draft on page 4, that the supposed lead agency would specifically be required to defer to the comments of coastal resource service agencies. Having a coastal district participate in a site-specific consistency determination and left free to interpret its coastal plan with the full status of a state resource agency is a matter which greatly concerns us. We see this complex procedure as resulting in endless opportunities for delay and confusion as to who can make a decision. Local governments will have a virtual veto power over any activity to be permitted on state lands by the state of Alaska and over any activity to be permitted on federal lands in the OCS. We think this is unacceptable. We're not unsympathetic to local control and favor local control of local matters. Many important petroleum activities, however, are of greater than local interest. We see the proposed procedures as negating protection of national and state interests and providing no net improvement over existing troublesome procedures. This, of course, is not our only objection. Complex new requirements are created by these proposed regulations that did not exist before. New public notice, new hearing processes, and administrative appeals procedures are established, which in our view can only serve to complicate and delay the processing of permits. Time does not permit going into greater detail at this time, but you will hopefully find the written material helpful, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions. This is a 5 or 6 packets of information, including our...
God, that's all we need.
You've already seen a great deal of that, Senator Gilman, and other presentations that we've made at CPC and others.
Some I have a full in. File cabinet. Don, in your view of the con- consistency rule in. As it exists now and as it might exist under the permit reform, the consistency, is consistency ruling a permit or not?
I liked what Murray Walsh said about that. He said a lot of people say that it isn't, but that it sure smells, and what else did it like? If it isn't a permit, it sure smells like one.
Many other responses, Mr. Chairman.
I've heard that caustic remark before.
Seriously, the reason that the industry is so concerned about consistency is that, in effect, it is a super permit. Unlike any other state agency permit, without a favorable consistency determination from the state, no federal agency can issue their permit or license. They are enjoined from doing that unless the state renders a favorable consistency determination on the activity. So in effect, whether it is a permit or not is a semantic problem, but in effect, to the industry, it is a super permit. It can give the state control over activities beyond the territorial limit of the state in such a way as no other state permit can, as strong as they are.
Senator, you weren't in the legislature at the time this thing was passed, were you?
When was it passed?
Well, Cape Bowling was still there.
77.
It was in 77, so. It's kind of ironic, and I think someone mentioned it a while ago, that John Tillinghast, in the waning hours of the legislature that year that it was adopted, that the domino that fell, that pushed the act actually into being, were the comments of the oil and gas industry in favor of the act. And, you know, and it's just kind of ironic now that we're hearing, oh God, what have we wrought? I realize that you personally were not involved in that.
The Alaska Coastal Management Program, as I understand it, the statute, doesn't give a local district full autonomy in CCM. It calls for careful development of a local plan by a coastal district, which then is to be carefully reviewed by the Coastal Policy Council to assure that it meets state and federal requirements, and again by the legislature. And quite possibly would be reviewed also by NOAA if it were to have strong effects on the implications of the state management program for state and national interests, let us say. And only after that would a district plan be incorporated into the state's coastal management program, by which future applications for activities would be measured. The consistency question being, is the activity consistent with the state's coastal management program? So as we see it, the procedures set off on quite a different tack altogether. They say that the districts should develop a plan, and then irrespective of whatever subsequent review takes place for that plan, they would be given the opportunity to interpret the intentions of their plan in connection with a specific site, specific activity. And therein lies the problem as we see it. It is quite one thing to develop a careful plan, have it reviewed, have it reflect all the criteria which must be there, found there by the CPC, by the state, and by NOAA, and then have activities measured against that carefully drawn up program. It's quite another to allow each district to be able, after development of its plan, to interpret its intention in that plan with respect to a site-specific activity.
Thank you, Don. Roger Allington. He's the guy that's responsible for all this.
I read the whole book to you.
Well,
don't you dare.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Roger Allington. I'm here as a citizen and former co-chairman of the Policy Council. And just a little anecdote to start off with, and it goes back to my younger days, and I did have younger days in spite of all the gray and the beard. With a missionary telling us in one Sunday school class about what would probably now be described as a third world country, where they were trying to dig a pit for a garbage disposal or whatever, and the common method of digging was to take baskets with sharp edges and squat down and dig and pass the baskets up. Never seen a shovel, and they took up a collection and sent up over a whole bunch of shovels so these people could dig and then throw the stuff out. Came out to see how they were doing, and they'd broken the handles off with all the shovels and were using them down like the baskets, passing them up. The point being, that's misuse of a tool. And I submit to you what I've heard Mr. Glass say and what I've heard others say, both here and other times, is that we have an excellent tool. I was involved from 1975 on in the development of the Act, and then sat on the council during the development of the guidelines and standards. What Mr. Glass just said is absolutely correct, that the Act envisions that there would be an orderly development of a local plan. That plan would have to be approved by the Coastal Policy Council, which part of the approval requires that the Policy Council see that the local plan has addressed issues of state concern, which includes national concern. For instance, oil and gas development, whether it's in the Beaufort Sea or the Shelikof Straits or wherever it is, has to be addressed. And if it is addressed, then the plan is approved by the Coastal Policy Council. It was then to go to the legislature. Once it was approved by the legislature, it became effective as state law. State agencies were required to adhere to that plan. Then it went to NOAA. Once NOAA approved it, then it became the federal consistency. I submit to you that is still what it says. That's where we should be. And that the permit regulations have jumped the gun, because frankly what has happened is that the local governments have not developed their plans yet. So what we have is a state plan that was adopted in very broad concepts. And the description I've used in Kenai Borough and the public participation we have is we deliberately wrote the guidelines and standards big enough you could drive two tanks through them side by side so that local governments could interpret them and narrow it down, whether it's over here or over here. Since the local governments have not done that interpretation yet, the state agencies are free to do it. And what you're having is state agencies making interpretations of the broad guidelines and standards, which may or may not be consistent with local government desires and certainly aren't consistent with each other. So along comes somebody who says, geez, we've got to see what this consistency is, and goes from there. Now, and what has happened, as I understand it, is DPDP has been making these consistency determinations. And I have to apologize to Mr. Waltz, because I should have brought this up before and I had completely slipped my mind, but Section 4640-100 of the Alaska Coastal Management Act specifically provides that the determiner as to whether these acts are consistent with coastal programs or not is left entirely to the Coastal Policy Council. Now, the Coastal Policy Council's regulations in the guidelines and standards have basically passed that on to the Office of Coastal Management. I question whether that transfer is probably consistent or not, but I find it very interesting that not the Office of Coastal Management nor the Policy Council is involved in these consistency determinations, but DPDP is. And some way or other, we've got to get this thing back on track. I think that the basic problems that are occurring with coastal management, and permit reform are due to the fact that the local governments have not developed their plans, due in part to the fact that state agencies, particularly CNRA, has not been projecting the money into the area. They've depended, they required early on that there be cash match, and there wasn't even any state funds involved in it. It was federal funds, 80%, and cash local, which meant that local governments couldn't participate. And we've gotten ourselves all tangled up in our underwear on this business of consistency when it's really not a problem if we can get the local plans going. Now, the thing that bothers me about the regulations that are presently in effect, and this does not apply to Senate Bill 84 because that is a statute, but as I read the Coastal Management Act, which is a statute, only the Coastal Policy Council can develop regulations that apply to the Alaska Coastal Management Act. Therefore, the consistency determinations that are in the regulations that are being proposed are in effect, and I'm not sure what the status of those is at this time, to me, are inconsistent with the statutes. I guess I've made a lot of notes and things, and I'll finish up so that I can answer questions, but two things I think have to be said. One of them is if the local governments will develop their coastal plans and get them approved by the Coastal Policy Council, it will eliminate a lot of the permit problems. Simply because once that plan is approved by the Coastal Policy Council, that becomes policy for the state of Alaska. Therefore, ADF&G, DNR, and anybody else that issues a permit, EPA or DEC, must be consistent with that local plan. If the local plan says you can drill, then you can drill. If it says you can't drill, then you don't apply for a permit. I can't imagine a plan being approved that prohibits drilling for oil and gas because it's inconsistent with the Act. So that's a bad example. But my point is, and the Corps of Engineers has said, insofar as the federal permits are concerned, if there is a plan that's approved by the Alaska Coastal Policy Council, it will expedite the issuance of permits. Was testimony at the Anchorage Coastal Management hearing the day after we had the Cordova meeting, whatever it was. And the Corps people made that statement that it would accelerate permits because it is a state policy then because it has been adopted by a state agency. But until that happens, you've got chaos out there. Because we've literally probably screwed up by making these guidelines and standards as broad as we did. Because it isn't a narrow focus. It's broad. Because what applies in Barrow will not necessarily apply in Ketchikan. And they were made.
I remember right, we had a hell of an argument about how we applied the Forest Practices Act in North Slope Borough.
That is entirely true, Mr. Gilman. And how you apply the Endangered Species Act to bowhead whales in the Hyder.
Yes.
The same thing applies. So that's my first point, is that somewhere or the local plans have to be done, and that's going to clear up the permit process faster than any of the regulations they've got, because it sets Coastal Policy Council by statute sets state policy. It's just that simple. The second thing I would say is that I think that we're all very aware that there are entities, some of them municipalities, some of them legally constituted but not municipalities, that do not want oil and gas development. And I submit to you, senators, that if you take away coastal management, that those entities will find some other vehicle to use to thwart that development. And I think one of the best examples that I can give is, as co-chairman, I sat with representatives of BP's Ohio, Mr. Walsh, and representatives of the North Slope Borough, and their agents, I should say. And I believe the question was zoning or planning the North Slope of Alaska in such a way that it would prohibit bringing pipelines ashore from the Beaufort Sea. In other words, absolutely thwarting development in that area. And whether you use the Coastal Management Act or whether you use Title 29, the local government can't thwart that prima facie. In other words, they can zone their whole coastline residential. And in residential, prohibit industrial uses, which means you can't bring the pipeline ashore. Now, if you do that through Title 29 zoning, my understanding of the law, and I'm not an attorney, is that the governor can, or the courts can, set aside that zoning because it is contrary to the state and or national interest. It requires a court action to do that. If you do that same thing through a coastal management plan, that plan isn't effective until the Alaska Coastal Policy Council approves it. They can't approve it because it thwarts a use of state or national concern. So you've got the same thing. Throwing away the Coastal Management Act is not going to speed up anything, and in fact, in my opinion, is going to slow things down. Because once you can get a new plan, the permits fall into place just right down the line. The activities of certain individuals and communities and entities to thwart development is going to be there no matter what. And getting rid of coastal management is not going to solve the problem. I'm throwing the baby out with the bath as far as I'm concerned. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, I got a bunch of scribbles here, but I think that I would say that the thing about thwarting development goes again to the question of, if you've got an EIS, why does the state agencies have to review the permit? Question you asked, Senator Mulcahy. And again, if you have an approved coastal management program by the local government, and in order to be approvable, it has to allow for oil and gas development. So once you have an approved program, there is no reason for Fish and Game to review it. The only people that have to review it by statute now is the Alaska Coastal Policy Council, and if they find the proposed action is consistent with the plan that's been approved, that's all that's needed for the permits to be issued. Maybe there needs to be statutory changes to require issuance of permits if it is consistent, because you do have people within agencies that don't like the fact that the policy has changed over what they like. They don't want the development, so again, they're using whatever implements they can to prevent the development. And I'm not talking anything you don't already know. But I would suggest, for instance, in reading SB 84, that some of the language that's in there that allows permissiveness in the issuance of permits and allows the departments to develop regulations be changed in such a way that the legislature says specifically what it means, and says it shall. I have to apologize to the chairman. He's aware of this, and I'm sorry, you, Senator Mulcahy. Senator Gilman was the chairman, was on the Coastal Policy Council and tried very hard to get through a part of the guidelines and standards that mandated approval of a local plan providing it met all the guidelines and standards. And I unfortunately took the other position and said, that's inherent in what it says in the Act. We don't have to have that in the guidelines and standards. We went through 2 months of Alka-Seltzer days with the Cordova Coastal Management Program because it was not entirely clear that the Coastal Policy Council was going to approve the Cordova plan, even though it technically met all of the requirements of the Act. And I apologize, Senator. I wish I'd listened to you at that time. I'll answer any questions at this time.
I wish you had it. Do you have any questions? Thank you, Roger. Murray?
I'm not sure how much longer.
I have a baby shower to go to at 5:00.
Well, I'm going to have to go pretty quick then. There's just an awful lot of stuff that's been said today that we...
Would you prefer to have some time to think about it and maybe put your thoughts in writing?
Well, we could definitely respond to you in writing. Let me make a couple of points about some of the main things that were said and some of the things the Coastal Policy Council is doing now.
Okay.
First of all, consistency has turned into a fairly important issue.
We always knew that it was a question that was out there that was going to have to be answered someday.
That we did. And we've done our level best to try and fit consistency into existing state procedures. It was suggested earlier that consistency gave rise to the regulatory reform effort. Well, I would have to disagree with that. There are a lot of things that regulatory reform addresses. Consistency is takes up a lot of pages because it is a multi-agency effort, because it is a fairly novel kind of thing. We think it's okay, switching to another topic, we think it's okay for the local governments to participate in the implementation of their own plans. It's been said here that others don't think that's okay, that if a local government comes up with a plan, they've addressed the state and national concerns as well as their own concerns. That plan has been approved. It seems entirely appropriate to us that, and to the Coastal Policy Council, that local government participate. There are so many checks and balances worked into the existing planning system as well as the proposed regulatory reform procedures that a local government cannot be arbitrary and unreasonable. And that's what people are afraid of. We just disagree. We think it's okay, but we do agree that we do believe they have to have a legitimate role. That's what local control is all about. As far as the specific cases that arose in the Beaufort Sea last summer before, there were issues at hand that had not been faced during the pre-leasing process or during the development of Prudhoe Bay. There was a question of whether or not there should be a drilling window. March 31 cutoff. We didn't come up with that question, but various state and federal agencies did, and we were saddled with trying to mediate it. The fact that some of the outcomes of these debates may not suit one applicant or another has nothing to do so much with the system, it's just he doesn't like the answer. There were other issues, the dumping of drilling muds and cuttings on the ice. There's a lot of drilling muds and cuttings. Gallons, barrels of them. Since that time, a couple of experimental islands have been allowed to dump their muds and cuttings on the ice to see what happens. So the system is flexible. These were new things. These were not old issues being rehashed once again. It was pointed out that DPDP has to act last. They act last. DPDP sends the extension letters to the Corps of Engineers and so forth. Very often, almost all the time, we are simply waiting on somebody else to act. And other agencies may have as much as a year to use in taking their permit. We have done everything we could to try and make regulatory reform solve the problems with consistency. We believe it has worked and will work. The next version of the regulatory reform regs will be out fairly shortly. Now the hearing period is over with. We've learned a lot, had a lot of discussions, and I think there'll be some improvement, particularly from the local government end. Now the Coastal Policy Council met about 2 weeks ago, shortly after the first hearings on Senate Bill 216, and had a very intense discussion with the third day that followed. Came up with six areas that they would like to make recommendations on.
I think you sent us that letter.
I did. I won't recapitulate those now. The council will meet again on the 8th of April, next Wednesday, and they will at that time be asked to endorse specific amendment language for local management program. So maybe these six areas covered plus others.
But I have to be very frank in saying the emphasis will be on local control. And as has been pointed out elsewhere, the local governments have the ability to say no. It's their ability to say yes that we're talking about now. And that ability to say yes is going to